We are now recording.
Okay, it's 9:30. I'd like to call this meeting of the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee to order. And if we could get a roll call, please.
Andrew Everode.
Here.
Peter Leeds.
Present.
Clarence McAllister. Here. David Swartz.
Here.
Paul Sperron.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. All right. Next, we would have a call to the public. This is a time where members of the public may address the committee during this call or in person here. We have one member of the public here. And the time for that would allow for no more than 3 minutes. And committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action within today's agenda. So, however, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anybody who'd like to address the committee?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Could you state your name?
Am I muted? Okay. Yeah, my name is Curtis Clock, KLOC.
And may I say, Mr. Clock, you're going to be speaking on Agenda 5A. This time is the call to the public, unless you had something else that you wanted to bring up.
Nope. Just that.
Okay.
Very good. We'll wait for 5A to come up. Anybody else like to address the committee? Hearing nothing, we'll move on from the call to the public to the adoption of the minutes, agenda item 4.
Mr. Chairman, this is Peter Leeds. I make a motion that we accept the minutes as written.
And I will second that.
Changes
I
or
I
didn't
think I
said anything. I didn't either. I didn't spot anything to do.
No changes.
Okay, then I'd like to just have a vote on the motion to approve the minutes from the May 4th, 2021 meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes to adopt the minutes. Okay, moving along, we'll head right to agenda item 5A, which is review, discussion, and possible action on the following changes to statute 4-30-102-2 regarding the Arizona qualifications to be a parallel, I believe this is supervising inspector. Okay, and was it Kurt?
Yeah.
Kurt, do you want to kick us off here with what you have to say regarding this matter?
Yeah, sure. I'll be super brief. I have owned inspection companies across the country. I recently sold an inspection company in Colorado that does more than $100,000 in revenue every single month. I've worked with engineering firms, insurance companies, et cetera. Girlfriend had an opportunity to move to Arizona, so I moved the business here. I was able to get my license here through the Universal application, which is great. But the problem is, even with my 15,000 house of inspections across the country and people pay me to train them, I cannot hire inspectors and train them because the state's law states that I have to have been licensed for 3 years in the state of Arizona. And so the way it's currently written, someone has to be here for 3 years and do a minimum of 250 paid inspections, which is the average of 1.2 paid inspections per week. So they are allowed to train inspectors. And me, who's been doing this for 15 years across the country and grown very successful businesses, is not allowed to sign off on parallels. And there's zero exemption for someone like me who has a military background, a small business owner, entrepreneur, plenty of experience to do it properly. And the last thing I'll leave you with is there's a lot of people out there charging for this, of course, and training people very, very poorly, causing fires, causing electrical hazards, causing all kinds of things. And they're out there training people, and I can't. So I'm forced to send any new person I want to a competitor to potentially be to pay them to potentially be trained properly. And I've exhausted every single avenue, and because of the law, there's really I just hit a brick wall every single time. So what I'm looking for is not even anything except for an exemption for someone like me who can prove plenty of experience.
Okay, I would like to refer, if we could, to our representative from the Attorney General's office, Scott, if you could just tell us there's really no exemption possibilities or any of that within a set of rules, right? That where you case by case these things?
Right. And the rules, there's a difference between the statutes and the rules that the board operates under. The statutes are created by the legislature and are enacted following a specific process. The rules are then clarifying of those statutes, and they are adopted by the board and go through a procedure that includes Governor's Review Council, the Rules Committee, to ensure that they operate within the statute. But the rules can't expand anything under the statutes. So the statutes will set up the boundaries under which the board has to operate. In this case, unless there is an exception under the statute, there wouldn't really be anything that the rule would be able to do to expand, to provide an opportunity for someone to come in under a different background or to come in differently. So it's going to be a question of the licensing department, what the applicable statutes are. I'm not familiar with this gentleman's case, obviously, in and of itself on its own merits, but the issue of whether or not he qualified to be a parallel inspector would be whether he qualified under the statutes and the rules that clarify the statutes. And the rules appear to be pretty specific in regards to what he would be able to do.
That's how I would understand that, too. So that would require a rules change. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. It would require a rules change in terms of if it was going to be something clarifying the statute, but it would not be able to expand the statute to allow him to become a parallel inspector if the in contravention of any statutory requirements. So whether or not it would allow him, if there was a change in the rules, to become a parallel inspector would depend on the statute itself. The rule wouldn't be able to expand that.
Do you think that a parallel inspector should potentially be a separate designation from a home inspector?
It is. It has its own definition, I believe, currently.
It does.
Oh, do you mean a different license?
Right, like a different registration type, which would allow. I mean, obviously that's another statutory change, but it would allow maybe some more leeway with situations like this.
Yeah, each case, it would be, I don't know if other agencies in the state encounter this, but these would be all case-by-case basis type situations, because a home inspector from back east could arrive here and our housing stock and our failure rates are so radically different than anything they've encountered that their ability to train newly, hopeful home inspectors is sketchy at best. You know, it's just almost impossible. So, I don't know what states we're referring to, but these are all just so difficult to sort through. They would be a challenge, and many folks from other parts of the country have never inspected a pool or spa. It's an integral requirement of our state licensure that be part of the education and testing.
But isn't that also an optional item on home inspections?
Mm-hmm.
For a client?
For pools, a home inspector can opt out of not even looking
Correct.
At a pool.
That's true, but you can't get a license without having at least 4 hours of training on it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Is there a way to address this through the universal licensing definitions? I mean, we have a whole program brand new to us. And by the way, sir, this is brand new to us as universal licensing. If in fact you had to prove to us that your qualifications from another state were similar to our qualifications, is there a way that we can have them prove to us that their qualifications to do parallels and peer reviews could also be proven.
So and, I think if you had a separate registration for a parallel, which we don't,
right?
Because there's just home inspector registration, and the rule states clearly that you, just as Mr. Clark said, if you're there 3 years. And
right. The principal issue that the board is going to run up against, it would be in a best case scenario, they would change the rule. The problem is they can't do that tomorrow.
Right.
So there's a question. There would be two real questions here. One would be the rule itself. One would be this individual case. And the answers may be radically different. I don't know legally that there is a specific course of action with regards to this, the case before the committee at the moment, not even before the board at the moment. With regards to whether or not the rule could be changed, and any rule can be changed. Again, it would just be a matter of making sure that it harmonized with the statutory scheme as well. If there are no statutory requirements regarding parallel inspector per se, then the board would be able to modify their rules to allow for someone out of state to become a parallel inspector. The other issues that would immediately come up would be what then would be the qualifications for a parallel inspector? Is it going to be the same as universal? Is it something where the board would make a determination that the jurisdiction from which he's coming would have a similar enough statutory scheme that he would be able to be a parallel here? Would they have to look at home inspector licensing in other states? So it creates a variety of interesting subsequent legal questions. And there is a difficulty in looking at a specific case and then potentially modifying a rule to accommodate that one case without considering potential collateral effect on the statutory scheme in general or the rule scheme in general. So it brings up a lot of potential legal questions for the committee and for the board.
And so we are working on the standards of practice change, which will require a rule change. So we're looking at submitting a rule change package at some future date. Is the status of acceptance of review with the state under some sort of lockdown, or is the GIRT open to reviewing the rule?
So any rule package has to be submitted first to the governor's office for approval to open the rule package, which would then go to the governor's regulatory council, review council.
I know I don't know everybody, so if I could just, this is Kurt again, and I just wanted to throw out that.
Kurt, hold on just 1 year. Second. You interrupted.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
I don't know this, but I have confidence that if there is something that is overly burdensome, some things that need to be addressed, or you know, that we would be able to get a rule package open.
Yeah.
So.
Good point. Okay, thank you for that.
I'm going to go with the positive.
Yeah. No, that's a good thought. All right, Kurt, you want to proceed there?
Well, I was just going to add that from my point of view, you know, with my experience, the 3 years being licensed in Arizona seems somewhat arbitrary. I don't even have a problem with the 250 paid inspections to the point that the person made about Phoenix houses having some subtle differences from other parts of the country. But why not just make it 250 or even 500 paid inspections? Because I'm close to that in my first 8 months here in town anyhow. So then, again, I'm just throwing that out there that the 3 years is what's really arbitrary and really doesn't serve any purpose to me.
Okay, thank you for that. Did I hear somebody?
Just on the rebuttal, that we debated that for months, years possibly. We figured that the 3 years is very important for the home inspector to get ideas over that period of time of different seasons, of the different things that affect the buildings out here. of and to have the possibility, even though they may have done 250 brand new houses, to see a variety of houses and a variety of problems. Now, I know you've got a lot of experience and you probably have seen a whole variety of problems. However, many of the home inspectors out here don't, and the parallels that they're doing are cookie-cutter parallels, and by the time they get into the system, they run into items that that are unusual and dangerous. And so the 3 years, in our opinion, was very, very important. Now, Mr. Chairman, well, if we were to help this gentleman out, the only way I see that we could do that is through a rule change. And if we were to change, we have the definition of the parallel inspections right here, and if we were to do a rule change, it would have to somehow include universal inspectors who have that type of experience. And maybe if we could get some people together, such as the gentleman on the phone, to see whether or not we can put together a definition of the rules that is that incorporates the universal licensee. Maybe we could put that in with the package with our standards rules change if the committee and the board agreed to it.
Yeah.
Kurt Winter, Assistant Director. Just also announce your names before you speak, just for good those time. Who are on the phone or who's speaking.
And this is Peter Leeds speaking.
And this is David Swartz. I started the discussion. So this would almost be considered a universal licensure parallel in supervising inspector exception or something that we produce or consider.
This is Judith. I would look to our legal counsel, but I would kind of steer away from making this just towards universal licensure, I think, but I'm not sure how to articulate it correctly, but I'm trying to think of, you know, different ways that maybe this could be looked at. And you know, with some of the other professions, it's a combination of your education and your experience that gets you to where, you know, registered in the state. And so maybe not just say with universal necessarily, but if you're coming with X amount of verified experience and, I don't know, help me out, where's that? And in the state, you know, so that it's maybe if you are extremely experienced and you still obtain a certain amount of experience in this state, but you're coming to the state with an awful lot of experience, like Mr. Clock has, that it could be, you know, maybe 1 year or something, or subject to board approval based on.
Well, legally, there also could be different requirements in that if you have somebody coming in with a universal background, because that's required for licensure, and this isn't a license, this is something you can do subsequently when you have the license but have met other criteria. In a case such as this, the other criteria, an option could exist for the board, for the committee to review and then make a recommendation to the board based upon perhaps a variety of submitted inspections or submitted inspections meeting certain criteria, such as over a certain period of time to encompass different seasons or different criteria the committee thinks would be applicable in every situation.
Like so the committee has variety that
Mr. Leeds was suggesting. So the committee would have some kind of quantifiable applicable standard that could go with anybody coming in here. Mr. Leeds?
Mr. Chair, Peter Leeds again. Is there a way that the board can actually waive this requirement, this rule? If in a board meeting with a presentation, does the board have the power to waive or modify a rule for an individual circumstance?
Legally speaking, the board has an undesignated catch-all provision in statute that allows it a degree of flexibility to accomplish its goals. However, that is a very unique power that would be used with extreme caution, and the board would need to be very cognizant of consistency in application of its standards because of the danger of an arbitrary or capricious act, which would put it in an entirely different legal framework. So while there is a catch-all provision to a degree statutorily, that would be an extraordinarily rarely, I don't believe I've ever seen it used, and in a situation in which the board is dealing with something that is likely to come up with recurring frequency, it may be good for the board to be cautious in its application.
So in essence, you're saying it is possible.
There's a chance.
Okay, and my next comment, Peter Leeds, once again, would simply be that if we were to change the rule, if we were to lower the time period for universal inspectors who have much experience and raise the amount of home inspections that would be required, that might be a good balance. Yes, ma'am.
I would again steer away from universal. The only requirement for someone to come here on a universal is that they're previously licensed for 1 year in good standing in their previous jurisdiction. So I wouldn't say universal. I would just say ability to be a parallel inspector.
Well, so, because we can knock all that out if in fact someone actually sat down to try to rewrite this rule, right? I mean, we could then debate all that. I'm just throwing out ideas. But the only people that would have trouble with this, you see, I would not trust a home inspector in Arizona who just got inspected to change this rule. However, I do understand experience in many, many states, all accumulating in Arizona. And so I have a sympathy for this gentleman.
Now, one thing as well to keep in mind, members of the committee, would be that this is agendized for discussion and possible recommended changes regarding the qualifications to be a parallel inspector. So it's not really agendized for a recommendation concerning any specific case or any exception to the rule. It would be agendized for recommended changes to the rule. So that really should be the focus of the discussion.
So yes, sir. That said, this is David Schwartz, and I would say that we should, would you two brilliant gentlemen, Paul and Peter, include this matter as you sort through standards type issues, and because they're headed at a similar path towards a rules package?
Mr. Chairman, this is Paul. I'm not sure that this is within the scope of our standards project, frankly. I'm not sure.
No, but you're an assembled task force already.
We certainly are that.
So otherwise, I don't mind studying it and perhaps talking to the gentleman here, Kurt, and see if I can come up with a solution. Do you have a preference? Shoot it.
Have a solution?
Whether we take a look at this one-on-one or include an existing task force? Is there any
or we agendize for the next meeting, right?
And not wait 6 months to meet.
Right.
Yeah, I think that would be great to agendize for the next meeting.
Well, let's put that on.
And come back with some possible verbiage for the
rule.
For the rule,
for a potential rule change, right? Okay, then.
Mr. Chairman, you're going to take that on yourself, then?
No, I'm going to.
Mr. Clock, if that's all right, I will share your contact information with Mr. Schwartz.
Could the director actually make a recommendation to us? as to how you would see this worded. You know what the problem is, and you know what the outcome should be. And you know that we need to stay away from universal licensing. So.
Yeah, I can stay in contact with you on that, perhaps.
Yeah, we can talk about it and then agendize it for the next meeting.
That sounds good. Okay, well, is there any other discussion on this matter?
Negative.
Very good. Well, thank you for bringing that to the committee. We appreciate it, and we'll work on that diligently.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Kurt. Let's see, is there anybody else on the telephonically?
I have Katie Cooper, but I think she's just listening in.
Just listening. Okay.
Then I had invited another individual, Kathleen, but she did not indicate that she would be here beyond I sent her the meeting invite.
Okay, very good. All right, moving on to agenda item 5B is discussion regarding enforcement of the requirement of producing home inspection reports or parallel inspections.
Mr. Chairman, this is my item I brought to the group. This is Paul Sterin. And since good timing for this topic here, right above the definition of parallel inspector in our handout, we have parallel inspection. The gentleman, Kurt, who spoke previously from the public was absolutely right. There's a lot of schools out there churning folks through for their 30 parallels. And I have the ability, you know, I have the in a position where I'm constantly interviewing folks. And the labor pool is pretty thin out there, I will tell you. And so many of these folks have been through the schools, had their parallels done, and the amount of folks that have said they've actually produced reports for majority or some any of their parallels is a relatively small percentage. There's a lot of these parallels that are getting done not anywhere close to producing a report like it says in this rule on paragraph 130.102. So it does say produce a written report. And I'm not saying we should come down heavy-handed on this. Number one, I want to make everyone aware that this is going on. And I will tell you the amount of new registrants that do come through that have actually produced 30 parallel reports, I'm sure it's a minority. There's no doubt, because folks have come to me, and I've asked them if they've produced reports. Nah, I just walked around with the guy. It was kind of it. I might have watched him do his report, but that was about it. So at a minimum, I'm asking this committee to at least help with the education process and maybe even our association chapter with reminding the parallel inspectors, the mentors here, that number one, they have a responsibility. I realize we rarely take them to task for not following through with their legal requirements. Occasionally we have, but maybe only a couple times. And I do believe that a lot of these schools are kind of taking advantage of folks trying to get into the business, and they're just not doing what's properly served. So at a minimum, to have a get information out, maybe in a newsletter, saying these are your requirements, we're reminding you these are your requirements, you must have the training of the trainee produce a report. It says right in the rule you're supposed to actually go through the report and mark it up and send it back. Again, none of that ever gets done, folks. I'm just letting you know the reality of it. Rarely does it get done. Maybe in some of the better run schools, but so let's at least try to get some information out. Maybe the ASHI chapter, who's been great to work with. There's a page on your website, Roger, that has all the different folks that have agreed to the state to help with parallel inspectors. That may be another little place on there that we can say, hey, there's actually some rules that you need to make sure you follow because it's actually the law in Arizona. So that's why I'm bringing it up to the attention here.
Well, I'm glad you did. I know that this topic has come up before. This is David, the chairman, and I think historically we've talked about, you know, you could always put in a complaint on the supervising inspector, and that is a requirement, so that could happen.
One idea that came to mind as Paul was speaking was we require that the applicant submit one home inspection report for review. It would potentially solve some problems if the state were to randomly choose which one, because they're sending in the addresses and the dates that they were performed. So if they don't know, you know, which one's going to be chosen, they may choose to produce reports.
That's a great idea. However, I would go even further. When we started licensing back in 2002, we required each and every home inspector to submit all 30 of his parallel inspections. Now, I know that that might take up a lot of file space, you know, but the truth of the matter is, Mr. Starin is absolutely right. And sitting on the application review committee all the time, I got so many on my desk all the time, it's unbelievable. I'm getting applicants sending reports that I wouldn't send to my daughter, okay? You think if you were going to send something to the state, by the time you did 30, you would have a beautiful report, number one. Number two, I've gotten reports where they have their mentor's name on it and their mentor's signature and their mentor's certification number. No indication whatsoever that they actually wrote that report. As a matter of fact, I've sent several back saying to tell them that fraud is an offense, okay? They're sending their mentors, their parallel inspectors, inspections to us, and we know that they're not doing the 30. It's very, very obvious, okay? Paul gets to talk to these gentlemen personally. I've been a home inspector all my life, and I don't associate with these dirtbags. But the truth of the matter is, we need to see that they did 30 inspections. And the rule is very clear, and we put a lot of time into writing it. You give a home inspection to your parallel inspector. He red marks it, sends it back. You make the corrections until there's no red marks on it, no matter how many times it goes back. That's why these gentlemen are getting paid for this. That's why they sign affidavits that they're qualified and they know the rule, and they're not following the standards. So we can approach this in a lot of different ways, such as David says, random, we pull one. I say take all 30 of them. David says put a letter in you know, and let them know that we're going to be looking at this. But we as a committee don't have the time, or any interested home inspector, we don't have the time to be filing complaints against all these parallel inspectors and having them come in and prove that they're doing it right. We need to have a way to check that.
Thoughts?
When they do their 30 parallels, would it be my assumption that the first parallel that they do is not going to be 100%? Because it's the very first one.
See, that's the assumption that they're all taking, and it's a wrong assumption. That they should not be moving to their second parallel until that first parallel inspection report meets the standard. They have to submit, or they have to go through, they have to create 30 parallel inspections that meet the standard, you see? So you can't take one that has 3 pages and then move to the next one that where they start putting something else in until finally by the 30th they have it right. That's not the system, although that's the way the system is being used, and that's the way many of these parallel inspectors understand it.
And I will tell you, one other factor in this may be a minor one, and I believe it's on the agenda here, has to do with standardized reporting systems. But part of the challenge is with reporting systems. You've got the training inspector who's using HomeGauge, and a new guy coming in, he's never seen HomeGauge. He's using Home Inspector Pro. Now you want him to generate a report using what? He's not familiar with the system. I mean, I realize that can be addressed from a training standpoint ahead of time prior to the parallels. But it is something that makes it a little more cumbersome.
But it can also be addressed during the first parallel.
Absolutely.
And no matter what format they're using, and personally I'm not interested at all in a standardized form, but whatever format they're using, we gave them a checklist, a supplemental checklist that lists every specific item of our 84 items that need to be in the report. And no matter what format they're using, they can find a way to get that in. I see it in the applications all the time. No matter what form comes to me, I follow that checklist that I can find where they properly addressed each and every one of those items. And if we start trying to get them, well, that's a different subject. That's a different agenda. But the truth is, it should have all been handled in the first parallel inspection. The most important parallel inspection is the first parallel inspection.
Mrs. Judith, so is your greatest or your greater concern with the parallel inspectors that they are not sufficiently training the home inspectors, or that they're allowing?
They're relying probably on verbal. This is what we're looking at, you know, and they're doing a verbal approach. And I know longtime folks like us used to believe that they didn't need to do all 30 with a report, and they might do the first five would be just follow me, stay with me, and we'll verbally go through all this, and then the rest you'll do your report. I've seen that. Over the years, we've seen everything. I'm just, in thinking of solutions, what if we did the report that gets submitted is random, and if there's any cue, like staff or the reviewing person, like you're looking at a submittal, if there's anything that is sketchy, like the supervising inspector's name on the report, then request all 30.
Here's an idea.
Then we're looking over all 30 all of a sudden, because we just simply don't believe that you did what you were required.
Well, the single report that they're submitting, I mean, they're choosing that report. So to say they submit one random report, wouldn't that require them submitting all 30 reports and then we're choosing one?
No, they submitted a
log.
There's a log.
And we could pick one.
The staff could choose one.
Instead of just accepting the one that comes in.
Yeah, and this is one way to address it administratively without messing with the rules, right?
I think that we have the ability to, I don't know that we should or not, but that we could ask them to submit all 30 based on what I'm reading.
We did that with the first 400 applicants, and it's no fun.
No.
How long on average is each report? How many hundred pages?
Well, 30.
Could be 30, 40, 50 page reports each.
On average, I say 30.
Yeah. And we could accept them electronically as an electronic option, but it's still cumbersome on a good day. I mean, that's a lot of.
You can't expect a
reviewer. We don't want to make more work
for 30 reports.
No, but you really wouldn't have to. What we're trying to do is get them to understand that they need to do 30 reports. So if they send 30 reports, we could randomly pick one and review it and send it along.
That's a point.
If you were the one applying and you knew you had to submit 30 reports,
I've been there.
Would you be a little more concerned with your submittal than if you were just submitting
one? That's the point. I would say. Absolutely.
Yeah. There'll be a massive file, so can you deal with 30 reports? Some of these are, I don't know how it gets sent out now, but I mean.
It have to be like a zip file.
Yeah, as if the problem. You're right.
Well, if they would have.
Go ahead. I have a question. Would that require a rule change? Because in the home inspector certification section of our rules, it just says copy of one report that meets the standards required.
With the application, but the logs there.
Well, the under the home inspector certification, it says evidence of completion of 30 parallel inspections.
Log.
Which is the log?
Oh, but then on.
Well, isn't evidence? Could
the,
that
the
be
reports themselves?
Yeah. I think, Mr. Donald, we're back to you.
I mean, Scott, evidence of completion of the reports could be potentially interpreted as more than just a piece of paper would say
needed. Well, evidence would be evidence the board accepts as indicating completion of them. So. And evidence doesn't mean that he supplies, his second cousin twice removed said, yeah, you got it all done, and he gives you an affidavit from that guy. He provides evidence that the board accepts as indicating this. Evidence of successful completion, that's going to be whatever the board accepts administratively for that. The log shall include, it's got specific information for what you have to include with with it. So, yeah, I mean, and the board can then administer it, however.
Mr. Chairman, do we have the ability to request an administrative assistance or change if we wanted to go with choosing a random of the 30, and if we wanted to pursue that, is that something you need a motion for? We would probably need to have that documented in the minutes if we were going to pursue that, if you think that's the way to go.
Right. I think we should have a motion to make our request that be how staff operates. Is that correct? That would.
Have we just?
Yeah. So
a motion to request staff.
Request that staff always do a random selection of the submitted report, and or submit all 30, whatever we're asking for.
Well, are we ready to make a motion, or are we going to take this up in discussion?
Let's go ahead and have a motion to make modifications to the application package requirements.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion that we recommend that staff require from applicants all 30 parallel inspections from which staff will choose one randomly for review.
I'll second for a discussion on it.
Discussion on that. Does that present anything logistically troublesome? Like,
they might just hold up perhaps the time frame. If you're saying if they haven't completed all 30 and then having to get one of those reports completed. So, are you saying all 30 need to be submitted and then we pick
that
them?
Was the motion.
That is the motion. That's that the motion. Could be a stack of paper coming in. Yep. That's the motion.
Yeah, so the paper situation is trouble. You almost always get them in printed form, right?
Yes.
So now,
they're all.
Can we just request them electronically?
Well, we only accept mailed-in applications currently, but we could put on the application that the report can be emailed.
Because they would. I mean, nobody's. These are all done electronically, right? Please tell me nobody's
correct.
Just.
I mean, theoretically,
so there
could be a.
So they're already saved rare. Electronically. It should be way easier for these people to just put them all in a zip file and send the parallels.
But
the
like
parallels.
Everybody's ability to zip up 30 files is not universal. You know, if you use Gmail or something, you're limited on any email application is going to have limitations of how many reports could be attached potentially. So you're going to get 10 emails to. To give them 30 reports.
Or they can be mailed in on a zip drive, and you know, thumb drive, right?
And then that might be an issue, is I know a lot of them write the page numbers like corresponding
right.
on the checklist.
We recommend that.
Might be, if they're sending it electronically, that might be an issue.
Yeah.
But
it's true.
And just to confirm one thing with the rules, if the committee wanted to. And I may be misunderstanding this, but if the committee wanted to request a copy of each of the 30 reports, there would need to be a rule change for that. The committee can request, under the rules, a copy of one home inspection report that meets the standards. So the rules do only require a provision of one report as well as the log of the 30. Administratively, the board, I believe that the rule is flexible enough to allow the board to request which one report they want, but I don't think that the rule would provide for a requirement that they provide all 30 of the complete reports.
How about in the case of suspicion of failure to follow the requirements of the application process?
And while you're researching that, Mr. Young, how about if a reviewer reviews and has a real serious problem and asks for another report from a different property? Is that possible? And from the reviewer's point of view, the applicant reviewer?
I think that under any circumstance in the application process, if there's a belief on the part of the board that there may be fraud involved in the provision of application, certainly you can request.
And that would be the case. If they're sending in like the supervising inspector's report, that's trouble. You should be able to request all 30 or
well,
to show that evidence?
This would provide for necessarily if you request all 30, but it would provide the basis for requesting another one.
While you're thinking about it, would that have to first go to the board? You see, the reviewer has a suspicion, says this is totally fraudulent, I need to see another one. Would we then have to bring it to the board itself for them to suspect fraud and judge on that before we can ask for that second report?
Well, right now you're getting pretty far down the speculative if that circumstance were to come up, I would say it would be very analogous to a situation where the board perhaps gets a transcript from a university and thinks that may be a fraudulent transcript. I would advise them to take the same course of action they would in that circumstance. I don't believe it would go straight to the board at that point. I think the board staff would contact the person and say, wait a minute, we believe there may be a problem here. And then they certainly could take it to the board. If the person insisted this is accurate, the board could then you can confirm its accuracy through contacting the university. So I would imagine the same process would be followed.
So if the reviewer had a problem, he would go to staff. Staff would have the ability to request, and then if it was objected to, then it would go to the board.
And effectively, the issue there would be that, again, the rule requires a copy of one home inspection report that meets the standards, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look, that creates an interesting situation because it requires one home inspection report that meets the standards. But it doesn't say parallel inspection report, it says home inspection report. So the definition of parallel inspection wouldn't necessarily apply. Parallel inspection is one that would be completed by the applicant under home inspection report.
When it's talking about evidence of completion of parallel inspections.
Under 6, yeah. But under 10, copy of one home inspection report that meets the standards in R430-301.01, which
isn't it in the context of parallel submittals, or, you know, your parallel documentation?
Well, that's what I'm checking to see. We under 3301.01. That is Home Inspector Rules for Professional Conduct. It would be a home inspection report that meets the standards of professional conduct. It doesn't say necessarily a parallel that meets the standards. So if the standard is of a home inspection report, at least arguably, if it meets the standards of any other practitioner's home inspection report.
That they didn't produce, you're saying? I find it hard to believe
Under R430-247C10, detailed a copy of one home inspection report that meets the standards in R430-301.01 and reports on at least one immediate major repair as defined in the standards along with the report checklist supplement and then sworn statement or statements by the supervising certified home inspector inspectors that the parallel inspections conducted by the applicant meet the standards. But that refers back to there is a requirement that they provide a log of parallel inspections. So part of the rule uses the term parallel inspections. Another part of the rule uses the term home inspection. So there is at least arguably a potential issue between those two different defined terms.
I guess. I mean, it's all in the submittal of your application package. It's obviously referring to the parallels that you perform. You're going to submit one of those. I guess we can play this.
Yes,
it's the intent. We know it's the intent.
Yeah.
So what could happen that's not happening right now is, the applicant submits their evidence of 30 parallel inspections, and right now they choose their report that they submit. So rather than they choose, we could have staff randomly choose.
Yeah, if we could.
That goes to the evaluator, and then if the evaluator is not satisfied that it meets all of the professional requirements, then it would be considered deficient. They could ask for another report to be submitted as part of their administratively complete application package. Right.
Except, this is Andy, so if you've got a log with 30, and the reviewer finds one deficient, so the most they have now is 29, if all the other ones meet the standards.
So
the whole application's deficient, isn't it?
It is, and there was a time, excuse me, this is Peter again, there was a time where they only had that one chance. However, that's really burdensome, and because the application process does have a bit of education in it. So what we do is we mark it up as a reviewer, send it back and recommend the corrections be made, and then it gets resubmitted to that same reviewer to check those corrections.
Okay.
And then it does meet the standard. It's, I mean, if we want to be really nasty, we could refuse it, make them do another, but I think going through the review process sets many of them straight. By telling them what they did wrong. And we've had this complaint in this committee before from us, who reviewed these applications saying these parallel inspectors are being paid to do what we end up doing in the application review. They're supposed to mark it up, send it back until it gets proper, then we get it, we check it, and send it on. But instead, what's happening is the reviewers who are volunteers not getting paid are checking it, writing up what's wrong with it, sending it back, and redoing it again. So we're doing the job that the other guy's getting paid. And we get angry sometimes. Not often.
If I could follow up real quick, Paul. So,
Peter.
Well, no, Paul was going to say something.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me that part of the reason for having the randomly selected report is so that, you know, you kind of get a sense of what their reports look like without them picking the best one. Under what you just described, Peter, if an applicant knows that even a deficient report, if selected, is going to be redlined, sent back, and they'll have the chance to resubmit that one, why does it really matter if the randomly selected report is deficient? If they know they'll have the chance to get it corrected and resubmit, it seems like the incentive, I understand, Paul, the reason for doing the random. I totally get that. It's a little bit like having the security camera that's not attached to anything. But does it have teeth, or does it really serve the goal of getting good reports if they know? I mean, that'll come out. People will understand that's the process. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah. And I see the problem. And also, if we they could have one report sitting on their desk waiting for the random and change the address on it, and how would we know? Change the name, the address, and the date, send us the same report regardless of what we choose. Unless we have them all in the shop.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is Paul. Back to the motion on the floor, which was seconded, and I believe the motion had to do with a full request of all 30 parallels to be delivered in some way, shape, or form. I'm just trying to clarify from the AG's office, is that still valid, or can we not request all 30?
That would require a rule change, I believe.
Okay, so we cannot request 30.
Right.
All we can request is the log like we are doing, and then we select the random one. And if it's contrived, and then, but at least we do get something in that way.
So, sir, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Peter Leeds once again. The maybe advising parallel inspectors, sending notices out to those who are on record as parallel inspectors, or in the periodicals for anyone who wants to be a parallel inspector, that the board is aware of what's going on, that the board is ready to pursue those that violate the rules. To put the fear of God in, you know, just to let them know that they're being watched, whether we watch them or not, whether we go through all this trouble or not. And then when the time comes where we do have one that's a blatant fraud, which I've had several, we can pursue those by complaint. And then the word will get out that we do pursue the ones that we don't like. Maybe all this should just be done through communication.
I have a question for you, Peter, because you've had a lot of experience reviewing those reports. And so are there a very small percentage? I know that they vary. Some are very close to meeting the standards. Some do meet the standards that you're reviewing. And some are catastrophically deficient. Is that true?
Very true.
And so is the catastrophically deficient percentage very low? That occurs?
They're all deficient,
but
except
I mean
a couple. If they're, let me just start from the top down. There is one school out there that has a program that they're using that's very good. They meet the standard every time. Everybody else is a little bit wrong. Some of them are very wrong. And then you do get the catastrophic one that's wrong. The guy, the home inspector, the applicant actually doesn't understand the system at all. And I would say that very bad one, the one that has to come back 2 and 3 times for review, is maybe 5%, maybe 2.5%.
So that said, and since the rule says that the applicant must submit proof of all 30, you know, in these special cases where we're hoping to protect the public from this person who has really no understanding, they ran through the gauntlet and they just can't really do the job yet. That we can ask for 30, you know, what is our range of options in that case? The goal of this agency is to protect the public. And so, you know, we have processes for the ones that are great, of course, the ones that are in between. We already have a working program. I think if we were to switch to the one random, that would solve a lot of these problems. But what we really want to protect against is that catastrophically bad one. So how do we deal with that? Can we ask for all 30 in these rare cases?
Well, asking for all 30 is a statute change.
Well, again, and there are two different parts of the rule here that sort of would feature in that. The one is, when I say that the rule only provides for provision one, that's under the one specific rule provision that has a requirement of a copy of one home inspection report that meets the standards. The rule regarding the 30 parallel inspections is evidence of completion of 30 parallel inspections. There is an argument that the evidence could consist of the 30 complete reports. That would be, I would think, would be sort of the extreme end of evidence of completion, would be 30 actual complete reports. So that might be, I mean, legally that would also sort of, that would sort of render pointless the requirement of a copy of one home inspection report because you would have already provided 30 under Section 6. So I would argue that for everyday use, that would be excessive for purposes of evidence of completion. But certainly a situation where the committee or the board has reason to doubt the veracity of what's been submitted, evidence of completion in that circumstance could be, you know,
better evidence.
Exactly. Yes,
right.
More complete evidence. Yeah.
Right. Because the other is kind of the construct of the application. This is what has to be with the application packet. So in light of that, can we just ask, can we modify the motion to request that staff do it on a random basis, the selection, and maybe perhaps notify the reviewers that exist on the EAC committee that review these reports that in the case of extreme deficiency, keep in mind that, you know, we can take these other steps.
It's all fair game. Okay, I will rescind my second.
Yeah, I rescind my motion. Did you get all that?
Well, what he said. Go ahead, motion.
Mr.
Chairman, may I speak?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Ms. Rogers.
This is just an idea after listening to all this, and I've done quite a few parallel inspections. I'm Roger Skaggs. I'm the president of Arizona ASHI right now. Would it be possible to have, we might need the assistance of an IT person or something, but is there a way to where each applicant can, put in their report onto the website through their application or something and be able to basically put it in like a storage locker online?
And their one report or all 30?
No, all 30 reports, and they just upload them as they complete them. The parallel process can take anywhere from, a month to years, depending. But would it be possible, that once when they get all their 30 parallels done, then the board just looks into their locker or portal or whatever it might be and just extract one of those?
I can answer that for you.
Okay.
At this time, no.
Okay.
However, this is a great example of why we are thick in the process of moving to a 100% online platform. That could happen once we move to an online platform.
So it is a possibility to have where, the board just, says, well, I want, inspection number 16, so I grab number 16.
They can upload anything, photos, different formats, okay. Multiple documents, whatever.
So maybe that's a discussion for another day then.
Yes.
Let something keep
future. And we get updates every time we meet, basically on the progress of systems and that as a rule.
I have one other follow-up question to something Mr. Everard mentioned a minute ago, in that if they have submit their evidence of 30 inspections and one is deemed completely
deficient,
thank you, and you don't spend time redlining and doing exactly what you were saying, so then at that point they need to submit another one. I get that, but now do they need to actually provide another parallel inspection to make the 30?
Yeah. Why? You have my heart. I would make them do that every time.
I'm just asking.
But it's encumbersome. It's
because it says that the inspections have to meet the standards. So you're clearly saying that reviewing one that comes nowhere close to meeting the standards. So.
And to take it another step, if the one that they decided to submit to the board, which should be their perfect example, doesn't meet the standard, how can we even begin to believe that the other 29 do? And so now we might be looking at 30 parallel inspections and none of them meet the standard. And I'm sure we are. And that's where it becomes problems because the governor would be right down on our throats when we stop certifying inspectors, which is what would happen.
And maybe this is Andy. Maybe this is just a first step. I think kind of what Paul's getting at, education, and then let's take this first step to randomly select one. We've gotten really far behind in the industry, so let's at least take this first step and see how we do.
Yeah, so I think I'm ready to re-motion, but as part of the motion, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need the aberration of additional requests. It sounds like it's already built in on the one-offs kind of thing, but it's normal procedure. So, Mr. Chairman, I motion that this committee requests that staff request a random report to review of the 30 presented to the BTR as part of the application package.
I'll see how that sounds.
Okay.
That might need to be cleaned up a little bit, but
that would be off the list.
And then not specify what happens afterwards.
And just leave it open to the needs of our
staff and reviewer and the board itself. Okay. I'm okay with that.
I'm sorry. Could someone read that back to me one more time?
Basically, Sarah moved and lead seconded that board staff requested in home inspection from the applicant randomly chosen from the parallel inspection log.
I think that does the job, right?
That's a good first step.
Staff okay with that? Okay.
Great. And just so you know, unless, because you keep saying it, ultimately the board, but these applications wouldn't go to the board until they are administratively complete.
Right.
So the board isn't going to be considering or looking at something.
Right.
You know, as far as where we're at right now.
Yeah, in committee.
Any other discussion? Hearing none. So we'll have a vote on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So thanks. All right. And now we're on to 5C, which is question. This is a question from the public. Does an individual need to be certified to be a certified home inspector to inspect pools and spas in Arizona?
So I can kick that one off a little bit, and maybe Mr. Parlin can help. So actually, Doug received an email from an individual, and he was, which I was impressed, I have to say, that he reached out to the board to ask, how did he phrase it, Doug? Basically, does he have to be a home inspector to be a certified pool inspector, I think was how it started. And you know, this was new for me. I'm like, well, what is a certified pool inspector? Do we have certified pool inspectors? You know, and I started reading and researching and reached out to Ashy, went all over the internet. I'll share with you. I was looking all these things, National Swimming Pool Foundation inspectors, all these things. My favorite was pool operator training on the CDC website, and they recommend, quote, that you contact your state or local government pool inspection group. Many are listed under environmental health to see what they suggest for pool operator training courses and to ensure the pool operator training courses meet state or local approval. And I'm like, I don't think we have any state or whatever government approved pool training courses. And then I read here that an at-home inspector can actually opt out on that anyway. So if they're opting out, that would indicate to me that clearly there's a niche market for individuals wanting to stay there, pool inspectors. And anyway, that was just a big rabbit hole that I went down on that. That took me all over the place on an educational journey. So into pool inspectors. So I didn't know, and I tried to find out percentages of home inspectors that generally opt out on pool and spa inspections. I really don't know. I mean, I asked a lot of people, and they said generally 20 to 30% would be their ballpark guess on that. And of course, we consulted our legal counsel. Do you remember this whole conversation?
Yes. And one issue is going to be that the committee and the board can't issue advisory opinions. The statutes and the rules are what the statutes and the rules are, and anybody who wants to come practice in Arizona can consult the statutes and the rules, but the committee can't tell them what they can and can't do under the statutes and the rules. That would be an enforcement matter if they do something they shouldn't. What this may be best for would be for the committee to perhaps, if the committee thinks it would be a good agenda item for a potential discussion about whether or not pool or spa inspection should be required in Arizona to be regulated by the board, that might be something for a subsequent agenda item, absolutely. But legally, I don't think the committee can answer this question for a member of the public.
My preference would be to not bring this to the committee because it's I think what you experienced was the difference between all the water chemistry and all these other issues are surrounding commercial pools where large swaths of the public can be at risk, and ours is more of a basic equipment operation, no water chemistry analysis at all.
Well, this individual was marketing himself to home buyers and sellers, specifically to say he was inspecting their pools.
I would have no interest in regulating them
I'm just telling you what came my way.
Can a certified inspector, who certified him?
Well, that was another question I had. And again, there is a whole
I guess you can get courses that you can take. You can get a course certification. Okay.
Yeah, let him do it.
Well, let him run in and do a pool inspection.
It's basically said, don't advertise yourself as a home inspector. You're not a home inspector.
We'll send them all the guys who don't want to do pools.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, but there was, in my experience, the vast majority of home inspectors are inspecting the pool if it's there on the property. The vast majority. It's low-hanging fruit, frankly, from a revenue standpoint. And almost nobody is just not doing the pool. So we never meant it to have jurisdiction over non-home inspectors. Of course, not everyone understands that in the consumers. And frankly, there's a lot of pool companies out there that may come in and do an inspection, but it's not what we do. They do different things. They get more involved with water chemistry. We're more about safety. They could care less about safety. So it's two different angles on things. But when we researched the pool and spa standards and cobbled those together, the three of us did, we looked at National Pool and Spa Institute, NPSI. We looked at all the different standards around when we put ours together. But we never, unlike our standards of practice that we'll be talking about here in a moment, it's got things that have to be included. With the pool and spa, we just decided to keep it separate as an optional for the inspector in case they choose not to inspect it for whatever reason, even though we are requiring the 4 hours of education. If we ever required the inspector to do the pool if it's there, I don't know, that would be kind of force-fitting, in my opinion. But.
And just for context, so that you know, we have Flagstaff in high regions of the state where they may have pools, but very few of them. So the inspector really never has a chance to gain true competency. So that's why we don't force them to inspect it if it's there, because if they're not competent, you don't want to require that. The state doesn't want to require that. So, you know, if you're in a region that you just don't have a shot at becoming good at it, that's why we have it optional. You do see some, but they're just too infrequent. And versus, you know, Phoenix, Tucson, where it's all the time, every day.
So I think our current standards and how we're regulating pools and spa, I think they're working pretty well, frankly, over this last, 10, 12 years that we've had those in play. And I think it's really helped to protect the consumer, and that was the whole thing about it. It was the biggest component that was not part of our standards. And hopefully the consumers benefited from what we've done here.
So I don't see a need for any action if we could.
But what we're saying is that if you're going to do a home inspector, you have to be certified. But if you're going to do a pool inspection, you don't have to be certified. However, if you're a home inspector doing a pool inspection, you do have to be certified. It's a little messy.
And that was my initial concern, was, you know, will the public be confused? And especially since, you know, Arizona, Florida, and California have more pools per capita than anywhere.
But we do certify home inspectors, and they become pool inspectors if they choose to do so. We don't have any jurisdiction over anybody out of the industry, out of the home inspection industry. So I don't see that we can stop it, other people from doing pools.
Especially registrar since contractors would have no interest in this.
Especially since we opted to make it optional.
Right. Okay.
All right. So moving along to 5D, this is a staff question. Should there be a preferred reporting software or minimum requirements of reporting software for the creation of home inspection reports for the home inspection industry? Where was this sourced from?
Staff.
You say so?
I think it just came up in just general discussions. And we just threw it on there to kind of get.
It doesn't sound like it's possible. It's not desired.
It's desired if it's my inspection report.
Yeah, he's very. But, like, everybody's mind works differently, so you're going to, a home inspector should be choosing the software that matches the his abilities to observe in the field and get his findings in written form, period. So, you know, there's lots of reasons to have these different reporting styles. There's lots of or reporting systems, and there's lots of them out there, and I think it should stay that way. I'm adamant about that.
Yeah, and just to add to that, and this is Paul Sterin, look at what happened in Texas, our first regulated state for home inspection, Texas. They regulated a report. So what's happening now is that that report is outdated, and so a lot of inspection companies, they're doing a state report, and then they're doing their own report, right, which is the real report. That's what that has manifested into.
They regulate tools as well.
Yeah, they over-regulate, obviously, in that scenario. But that's an example of someplace we don't necessarily need to go. And that, none of that's helping the consumer. The consumer's there with two reports. Well, which one is the right one? And one has additional things that the state says you should not include. So it's a little overreaching there.
There's it's a wonderful variance. Okay, everyone is different. To be able to project what you see, any adverse conditions, good conditions, no matter what, in your own words, in your own way, makes this industry very competitive. And I believe that that would be my greatest argument to leave it as it is.
I know my opinion was always that of Jason Fuchs. Remember, he always said, we don't make rules for tools. And I always thought that was a very good saying, and it applies in so many ways with the drones, and I think in this situation as well. But
yeah,
just it was good just to hear you guys' thoughts about it, see if they're kind of parallel with us.
Yeah. That's good feedback. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, a lot of the major report manufacturers, they know what the Arizona template, if you will, looks like, you know, from the larger manufacturers. They've already got that figured out and got that cookie cuttered. And it's not that hard for any report system to meet our standards. It just takes a little work, right?
And I think this came up in ours because of just how many times people come before the board because, my software... there's a screw up in my software, so I forgot to put that in my report or something. And so we were like, why is their software not doing it correctly? At least that's what their excuse is. And
oh, yeah. And we've seen it over the years in EACs where you get the same report system, has the same defect in the report. You know, it carries through the report system even beyond what the inspector does.
Okay. It always pays to read your report before you submit.
Okay. Does that answer the question? Well enough.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful.
Thank you.
To 5E, which is a committee question, what constitutes similar licensing standards among states?
This is a carryover.
The universal licensing. Yeah, and I'm just, along those lines, it kind of dawned on me because I had spotted just the other day, actually, the some newer schools are popping up and this and that. They've become approved on the list. And so the person that was wanting the universal licensure that was able to get a hold of me, they had said that their classroom education was through InterNACHI, which is now approved. And they have thousands of classes, and so I just want to make sure the agency knew what are the Arizona required classes, and so I kind of wanted to hand that over, because if they just, there's actually a certificate that has to be included that is should reference Arizona requirements. And so that's just a something on that, but this person's coming in, so that would we're gonna deal with the requirements in the classroom, and then how does staff now deal with the parallel aspect of another state, whether they require it or not? You ignore it?
Yep.
Parallels are ignored, even though it's a requirement of this state.
We made it up.
even knows what it is.
So do we care where they got their classroom education?
Well,
or if it even is related to Arizona, or if it includes the 4 hours of pool and spa? I don't know that I brought this up. I'm carrying the ball. But I don't know that this was...
You're doing a great job.
I don't know.
I think my understanding is that it's completely two different paths of licensure.
It is.
And so
and we
whatever
have no
this
control.
One is and what this one is, they're just separate. So if you meet these criteria, you'll get the registration, or you can meet the criteria through this avenue. And they get to choose which one.
Do we know what the criteria is?
Yeah, could
path.
It's could we restate the reciprocity?
It's in universal in there. You want to take a look at it?
It's in the packet, right?
Establish residency in Arizona.
Substantial similarity of practice of area of regulation. What it is they're authorizing you to do.
There was a lot in the packet.
Serve the same education.
Right there. Yeah, there are some. Yeah, it has. Universal has more to do with state of Arizona accepting that another jurisdiction regulates the same area of practice and has determined that you're qualified to practice in that area in their jurisdiction, and therefore we will allow you to practice in the same area of practice in our jurisdiction because we trust the other state's ability to decide that you meet the requirements to do that. So it has more, it's more outcome based as opposed to the educational route, which is where Arizona is saying if you're applying for licensure directly, we require that you meet these certain criteria in order to be able to practice. Universal just means somebody else has made that threshold determination and you're accepting their ability to make that determination.
So every other state, no matter whether it's substantially similar requirements or not, are just in.
If they have certification.
If they have a license.
Right.
So then you're going to get people here that's never seen a pool.
But that's going to be based on what it is they're licensed to do. So you have to look at what the actual, such as, for example, if you were in Arizona going for Universal in another state, if the other state lets home inspectors, or as part of the requirement, home inspectors necessarily inspect pools and spas, they might not accept Arizona as Universal because the Arizona license doesn't necessarily authorize you to, you know, it may authorize you to elect to or not to do it, but that's not really part of the license. So they might decide that actually the Arizona license doesn't cover the same scope of practice. So you're looking at the scope of practice principally when you're looking at Universal. So you have to look, just because somebody's called a home inspector in Idaho doesn't mean they're doing the same thing as one in Illinois.
Who's looking at their scope of practice?
The board.
The board itself or staff?
Well, now we're in an administrative area, so.
All Universal applications do go before the board for granting, and the applicant does have to include their rules and statutes from the state for which they're licensed as part of their application.
Why?
To show that it is substantially.
I thought so. That's where I'm confused. Does it matter that it's substantially similar or not?
Well, for example, you could be an engineer in Delaware, and Delaware may have an engineer designation that allows you to do civil and structural. In Arizona, you may have a civil or a structural. So if you're applying to be an engineer in Arizona, it's not going to be the same thing. Board staff has to know what the scope of practice is there, and what they're doing out here would have to be a substantially similar area. You can't be authorized to do something in Arizona that a license here wouldn't allow you to do because you're allowed to do it there, and you can't get a license here to do something that you aren't licensed to do in another jurisdiction. So you have to make sure that they're roughly the same.
Quorum's three.
What was that?
Quorum. We're making sure we still have a quorum.
Yeah.
Okay, so the...
Oh, yeah. You know what? Would you allow Heather to just refresh us on the statute?
So good thought.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, I did pull up the statute, and it's ARS 32-4302. And to answer parts of the questions, there's many sections. There's about 7 or 8 paragraphs. But paragraph 2 says the person has been licensed or certified by another state for at least 1 year. And then this is why I believe Julie stated why we require the statute in the other jurisdiction and rules. It says when the person was licensed or certified by another state, there were minimum education requirements and if applicable, work experience and clinical supervision requirements in effect, and the other state verifies that the person met those requirements in order to be licensed or certified in that state.
In that state.
Right.
So whatever
their requirements
schools they require, or yeah, in that state where they're coming from.
Okay.
And bear in mind also that if something came to the board and say the board members felt like they were lacking and wanted to deny the license, it would have to go to the governor's office.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting. I have a family emergency. Is there anything you're going to need me to vote on here? I have to run.
And can you can carry the ball on that?
Yes.
I can carry
we still have a quorum, right?
Yes.
Thank you. I am sorry.
Hope she's okay, Peter.
Yeah,
it's
going to be tough. She's my wife is stuck in Syracuse, New York. Her chip's not working on her card. And she's at the airport, been there for 3 hours already.
Oh, shots in her chip.
I'll be in touch.
Thank you. Very
Thank
good
you,
meeting
Peter.
See
Thank
you.
See you, Peter. Be in touch with you, Peter.
Everything's okay.
So, regarding the universal application, we're not waiving the National Home Inspector exam, right? That is a requirement. Is that correct? Regardless of what happens, where are we with the exam?
And Mr. Chair, committee members, there's another section in that statute that says the person previously passed an examination required for the license or certification if required by the other state.
If required by the other state.
Yes.
So they could be home inspector in Arizona and not pass the exam, huh?
The only...
Not a big fan of that.
Well, the one variation to that would be that the statute does require that if there is an Arizona-specific exam, you can require them to take an Arizona-specific exam if it's a requirement of all home inspectors. But it would be only if there's an Arizona-specific component.
Well, there is. We went with a national exam, yeah.
Right.
Well, that's not helping our home buying consumer, that's for sure. We decided on the National Home Inspection Exam because it was the best one out there, and it still is. And if someone's coming from a state that does not require an exam, then they still don't have to take it if they've met other requirements.
So a lot of professions do require both a national and a state-specific.
But, Mr. Chairman, when we were talking about reciprocity over the last year or two, the exam subject came up, right? And I thought we were somehow able to require that as part of the reciprocity, but maybe...
It was actually like parity, was it not?
There's a different... Yeah, reciprocity would be something that the board was working towards having a statute regarding reciprocity with other states, but that's different. This is universal licensure, which the legislature, the governor and the legislature...
Two different things.
But yeah, it's a...
Thank you.
Similar to different.
Yeah, so we understand.
And just for a quick little information, and as of August, there were 16 granted home inspectors for universal licensure from the beginning of the program up to August last month.
Okay.
Thank you
for that.
16.
All right. I think that answers our questions on that.
I actually have something for this agenda item. We had a potential applicant who was coming from California, which is not a regulatory state, and so would not qualify for the universal licensure. But obviously, he expressed some frustration on that and wanted to, know, about the parallel inspection specifically, the need for the 30 parallels, because he has been, he's a licensed in, I mean, a home inspector in California for over 20 years, you know, very experienced in that, and wanted to know if there are any exceptions or anything that could be done in that regard.
No, the committee wouldn't.
Yeah, and we also don't feel that it's an onerous requirement to go out and get the 30 parallels. There's lots of resources to do that. It shouldn't be an inhibitor to licensure, one would hope. It's just a matter of going through the motions. So.
Okay. Next item on the agenda is 5F, committee member election.
This was a holdover from the last.
It was?
Yeah.
Oh, because, I mean, huh, interesting.
It's been so long since we had that meeting, I just don't know why.
Yeah, the COVID messed up one more thing, right? We keep things on the agenda that we can't get off. So I don't have a question on this, do you?
I do not.
No.
Okay.
I don't mind.
Maybe Peter did. Okay, well.
You want to be chairperson or something like
that? There's a code.
Yeah, I already gave the warning, the early warning pulse. We'll talk about that later. Okay, finally, we have item 5G, which is the standards of practice revision. I hate to go through this in the depth we were hoping without Peter, because I think he's integral to the process, but we could... perhaps go over it briefly and then maybe move on to the director's report, if that'd be okay. If you could give us a status, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And Peter and I are all on the same page here. Not that, you know, I don't want to put any words in his mouth, but we kind of took it to this point. What I put together, it's about two-thirds down in the handout packet, is... is kind of a project update on this task force, and it's right after the Google Drive link. And by the way, that Google Drive link is not updated with all of this information, and just ensuring we're not violating any open meeting rules regarding that shared Google Drive. This information here is the first time this committee's been presented with it. So I'm just going to do a quick review. I'm not going to dig down deep on the project summary topic areas. I'll do a quick review, and then I'll be happy to answer questions, or please stop me along the way. I'll keep it brief here, Mr. Chair. Peter and I and Mr. Skaggs, President of Arizona ASHI, the American Society of Home Inspectors, are this task force meant to update the standards of practice for home inspectors in Arizona. Our standards are 20 years old. Interestingly, I think the BTR this month is 100 years old. If I'm not correct, 1921. And I saw that because when I was looking through the standards this morning, the Arizona ASHI chapter actually puts a nice little blurb about the BTR in that we hand out, that the chapter hands out and sells to Arizona home inspectors, and has a little bit of history on the BTR and who's regulating them. So the idea to update the standards has to do with things we've learned over the last 20 years, along with updates in technology and probably some updates in our actual standard of care. As home inspectors. I just listed the stakeholders here on those three bullets. Frankly, the biggest, most important stakeholder not listed there is the Arizona home buying consumer. That's who's behind all this, who we're trying to help protect. Under project summary, I just noted the eight initial areas of discussion, if there's any specific questions, let me know. Again, this was not designed to dig down deep into too many areas, but if someone has a specific question, let me know. What I didn't put in there under number one is also carbon monoxide detectors. They weren't really around that much 20 years ago. Now they are. We're going to be grouping CO
and smoke detectors together. AFCI outlets are newer type of circuit protection that we're seeing that our standards have to address one way or the other. Either we inspect them or we don't. Kitchen appliances, another kind of part of a standard of care for the built-in appliances. Most inspectors have been doing them for many years. It was about time our standards kind of caught up with those. Testing of garage doors, solar systems, both photovoltaic and water heating type solar systems. We're just seeing so many of them. Our standards have to address them, and we need to figure out if we're inspecting part of these systems or we're disclaiming all of these systems. And that is one of the bigger questions moving forward. Bedroom fire egress. How do you get out of a bedroom in case there's a fire in the hallway? That's never been part of our standards before. It's one of the most important safety things that we as inspectors look for. And I've done some research as far as why it never got addressed, and it mostly had to do with how to wordsmith it, which is why we may take a stab at that. The dual pane window we currently have, I think it's one of our most recent substantive policy statements having to do with the disclaiming fogged windows for home inspectors, essentially, and that we are not required to note on fogging of windows in homes. While many of us do, it's not a requirement. So there was a standard policy statement drafted, and our thinking was to include that now in our SOPs and maybe lose the substantive policy statement and take that as an opportunity to clean it up.
I apologize. This computer will not let me in without a login to see the doc.
Can you use Peter's?
There should be a password on the back.
This one's still active here.
Oh, it's just at the bottom of the...
It's in the packet.
So then where is that? I'm an Apple guy, so I'm...
Let's scroll down to just a page or two.
So while we're looking at this, I guess the other question is there any other substantive policy statement that is worthy of technical inclusion into the SOPs besides the window pane?
There is.
There is.
I just looked at that yesterday and pulled this up. It's at number 11. We might as well put this in the standards. This was the source and endpoints of systems.
Oh, that was the whole electrical subpanel?
Exactly.
Piece.
So you can have that.
Okay.
And then this is the dual, or the dual pane window one.
That's the window one.
So it's not only window fogging. It can be things like the low E coating. You know, they'll get those little starbursts at times that are hard to spot.
The right. I know it's worded, and they're cosmetic defects,
yeah.
I think.
If you use some, if you pull and highlight and pull some of that language, it's basically anything going wrong within the inside of the two panels.
Right.
Period.
Right, right. And keeping in mind that this is also buffered with the fact that we're required to note adverse conditions, and if it's really obvious, the inspector's probably going to note it as an adverse condition. We're talking more here about the minor stuff that we may get dinged on, you know, or... when the sun's at the right angle at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can see a haze on the glass, that kind of thing. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll look at this also for inclusion into that. But now is the time when we're cleaning these things up. And it's also a time for anything else that's been learned on the enforcement side, EACs, if there's anything that we keep pinning our heads on, or we, you know, anything with the SOPs, now's the time to kind of take a stab at these. There'll be a couple of adjustments in the glossary, frankly, and one of the challenges is even back to kitchen appliances. How do we limit the inspector's liability? You know, my oven has 23 different settings, you know, so what is the inspector's responsibility on an oven, on a built-in microwave, on a built-in cooktop? Dishwashers. So trying to limit that, and we're going to attempt to do that at some point. Not at some point. We're going to attempt to do some of that maybe through the glossary. Looking at the activities, we how this task force started from a previous Rules and Standards Committee meeting, bringing in Roger Skaggs right after that. Peter Leeds and I, with some input from Roger, kind of worked together this summer. Peter and I met on July 9th and started cobbling some of these together and started the discussions from the investigations that we had done. We brought Roger back in after that and kind of drafted kind of where we're at so far. Finally, on activities planned, on the bottom here, we've got today's date on updating the BTR with where we're at with this project. And frankly, the project has been delayed due to COVID, but we are definitely on track now. The thinking is the next step here is maybe a larger stakeholder meeting. We've been working with Roger and Peter and I as a subcommittee in a little bit of a vacuum here. Our thinking is now to open it up to a larger stakeholder meeting, maybe bring in a couple experts, maybe bring in some other of the larger multi-inspector companies from around the state, let them weigh in. And I know it sounds like a messy forum, and it probably will be, but I think it's something that we have to do, it seems to me, in order to try to come to consensus. The hope is to come consensus as a committee. I'm not sure we can. I believe we can, but if we can't for some reason, we'll have to come back and figure that out if there's two of us that are in contention on how something should be drafted. My hope is that that won't be the case, and after the larger stakeholder meeting, we can boil it down to what we can all agree with. The challenge is home inspectors are very opinionated, and we're opinionated on everything that we do, including how we change our standards. We live, eat, and breathe these things every day, so we're all very passionate about it, and if for some reason we don't come together 100%, don't be surprised, the last piece of this is, after the stakeholder meeting, doing a redraft of the standards, and then I guess I'll put it back to what the next logical steps are. At some point, we'll need Scott's Attorney General's office review of the draft verbiage to make sure everything is enforceable and makes sense. And at some point, I assume it's at the end of the travel, we'll have to go to GRC. I'm assuming at the end of the line with this to make sure everything all makes sense on it. So that is our update, and I'm happy to take questions on it.
So speaking of opinionated folks, so I'm not allowed to see or discuss or give input unless we do it here.
Quorum.
In the quorum. So I would like to see a draft of what exists in terms of, do you have a document where I could review the proposed changes or the additions or whatever, deletions?
It's at this point, Mr. Chairman, it's incomplete. Since there were so many things up in the air,
yeah.
We're not close enough to have a draft. We've got some draft statements in a working document, but I'm not that close to having a revision of our current SOPs with proposed SOPs. I'm not close enough to that point yet, showing the strikeouts, and okay. I'm not quite there yet on this document.
Then,
and certainly not during the confines of this meeting.
Okay.
You could submit it, anything that you have. I mean, knowing that it's a draft and a work in progress prior to the next meeting, couldn't we include that in a committee package?
Sure, it could, yeah. It could, if you go out in the committee package, any draft document you have, yeah.
Oh, I certainly would, yeah. And certainly by next meeting, depending on the timing and where it fits in with our project timing, I'll certainly have something to look at. But
I just request it because I'm excluded unless we do it that way, right?
Or unless Peter wasn't part of it and then you and I were. And therefore, we could discuss it without a quorum. But I don't know if there's a mechanical way to do that or not.
Well, as this is a subcommittee.
Peter and I and a public member.
Yeah, would actually, because I think that subcommittee was designated at one point.
Correct.
So there would actually have to be a removal.
Well, that's true. That was a motion. That's correct, Scott.
And then there'd have to be a new motion to have you to make a new subcommittee.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's
considering two of your committee members, then you would inevitably have an issue otherwise because of quorum.
I think I'd prefer to just get a look at in writing at whatever progress is as it's going for each meeting we have.
Absolutely.
As it progresses, rather than now go to a big, larger stakeholder meeting, and then I'm still excluded. I don't know what it would look like at a major conference for me to be in the room, and you know now I'm exposed to it and I'm giving input. It's just kind of awkward.
The committee could also have another meeting prior to the stakeholder meeting. It could schedule just a one agenda item. To review, and you could provide the materials, and then you could.
And we could do that on a Zoom call. It would just be an official meeting.
Yeah, it would just have to be properly noticed and agendized. But,
if we could do that, just so I can have.
Prior to the stakeholder meeting, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I just prefer to not be excluded from everything.
But just keeping in mind that it's going to be a bit sprawling because there's a number of balls up in the air right now.
Yeah.
We can address it this way or this way, propose verbiage. You know, it could be a little unruly because it's not going to be very clean because there's a number of things up in the air. So just so we understand that. In other words, I may be proposing something, but Peter may be proposing something else.
Okay, well.
And I don't want to infer that mine might win.
Then I would prefer that you wrote what you would propose and then Peter writes what he would propose for that specific item, and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
And then when we go to the greater stakeholder meeting, whoever goes to that, we have rationale built. We've thought it through. We've had all of our collective minds on it, and we win the day with the debate about why.
Okay. Absolutely. Very good. Scott, at one point, once we've got a completed draft, then you want to put your eyes on it. At one point, you want to get in on this?
Once the committee has what they would like, I can work with board staff as board staff begins to get involved at some point. The important thing at present is going to be for the committee to have the language the committee would like to have in there. I would get involved through board staff.
And if you preferred not to do the pro and con in writing, not pro and con, but your position and Peter's position in writing, we can just do it at a meeting. Because there's not all that many items, right?
Right. There's not all that many items.
There's probably agreement on many of them, right?
There's agreement on the majority of them.
That's what I thought. Okay. How many would you say are...
contentious?
Three. Three?
Just... As a heads up, which ones too?
As a heads up, which would you say are the contentious ones?
Garage doors for one.
Garage door openers, GFI testing, and solar systems. Those are the ones that we're kind of grinding on a little bit right now.
2, 4, and 5 of those?
Yep.
This is GFCI / AFCI. Is it
correct?
Both of those are contentious or just one of them?
Well, really the GFCI testing specifically, there's a current requirement to test GFI outlets, all GFCI outlets in our SOPs. And now moving AFCIs in and not requiring AFCI testing, the thought is to follow national standards and not require GFCI testing, not require it.
My experience on the GFCI testing requirement based on doing a lot of EAC complaints is that you have to test the one
with
that
the
has the buttons.
Right.
And all others you do not have to verify.
That's currently what our current standards are.
So that's contentious?
It is. It does not follow the national standards, which do not require GFCI testing.
Any of them?
And they do not. And, well, I haven't checked on Internachis. I did look at Ashies on this, and I got the rationale. And through this process in my investigation, I'll let you know, I had a meeting with Bruce Barker, who is the current president of ASHI, who is the current author of the ASHI SOPs. He is the one who did the last ASHI revision in 2014. He wrote a book literally on this stuff. So he's kind of the horse's mouth on National Home Inspection Standards. And it was also decided at the time, I think, to group AFCI, GFCI together as their two different types of protection for circuits, two different types of circuit protection, and to look at them in the same way that our SOPs do. Much, somewhat the same as smoke detectors and CO detectors are addressed in our standards. I will try to cobble together a draft then per the recent request here and try to get a couple different sides of input on those several contiguous issues, and then I'll coordinate with Roger and Peter, and we'll get the other folks and Brick and Bruce and get those guys in, and maybe use this as a working document that we'll have along with maybe some of those pros and cons, and see if we can sift through and come to some understanding on what we think makes the most sense. And Roger, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to throw in on this since you guys are so involved.
No, about the only thing is that, you know, ASHI is on board, you know, Arizona ASHI in particular is on board with the change of the standards. It's just these standards, you know, they've served us, you know, for 20 years, and they actually go back to actually 93 because they were derived from ASHI standards that were issued in 93. So, I mean, they've served us well, but it's getting to the point to where things need to be addressed because there's new systems, just like Paul said many times over, you know, there's new systems, there's new materials, you know, that come out, and, you know, so we need to be able to address those, you know, through the standards of practice. So that's, you know, that's what I'm doing here is to, you know, let you know that Arizona ASHI is on board with all of it. All the changes, and want to be instrumental in you know, providing, you know, more protection for the inspector as well as the public.
So, what was done 20 years ago, as far as the SOPs were concerned, was the Arizona chapter was involved with finalizing the standards. The Arizona chapter adopted the standards by vote of the chapter. And then the BTR then adopted those state association, if you will, or association standards. So we're assuming a similar path here unless we hear anything different. But that's what the chapter is going on, that we're going to go ahead, make these revisions, work through the chapter, have the chapter approve those revisions, and then come back to the state here. Okay.
And we do that because they're so substantially similar to a proprietary standard that we want them to endorse what we're doing as a state. And historically, just in the beginning, it was natural and normal for the agents, for the BTR, to reach out to the what are the associations requiring of their members and then adopt that type of standard. So I don't know if that still goes on or if there's original standards drafted very often, but I don't think we'd want to go down that road. It's just too cumbersome.
Just so you know, with Peter gone, I've got about 5 minutes, and that's
yeah,
going to affect
no
more.
Problem.
And I'm also happy to run to my car and call back in for another 20 if needed, but you tell me.
I'm done with my review unless anyone had any questions, though. I thank you guys for your time.
Great, I can do the director's report in 30 seconds for you.
Go.
I know you already had to read it. And basically, we turned in our budget package for the next fiscal year. We have appropriation granted for this fiscal year to digitize documents. We're in the process of doing that, as well as continuing to work with the online transition vendors, which we have asked for appropriation for in the next fiscal budget. And
It looks like you've got about 1,000, just under 1,000 currently licensed or certified home inspectors out of the board's almost 32,000 registrants. So what percentage that is, can't think that fast. And there's currently 19 active complaints with involving home inspectors. So those are like 30 second rundown.
I have a couple of questions if I could.
So
the lot of laws are going to take effect, you know, the end of September here. And so are there any laws affecting the agency that are coming up to disrupt anything?
Just the definition of engineering, the change. I don't think there's anything that would be affecting the home inspectors.
Okay. And then one follow-up question, too, is it was like last night I watched the news and they're reporting that the DPS has some problems with accuracy of background checks. And it's some sort of, it seemed to me, if I understood the reporting, that it's some sort of interaction between different states, perhaps, and things not correlating.
That's very interesting. I haven't heard anything
about that.
It's brand new news.
It's not.
That's funny, though, because Julie and I actually had some questions about that recently, so we'll look into that and make that a future agenda.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up because I just saw it last night on the news.
Yeah, it's a very good topic.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That amazing report. I like all the data's here. Thanks for compiling the data, everyone, and everyone involved, and thank you, everyone, for being here too. The future agenda items I know we need are 5A and 5G. Is there anything else we can think of for anyone?
We didn't agendize anything else.
I don't either. We can always add it if needed. And as far as a future meeting, do you think sometime next month there could be something written that we could have a roundtable chit-chat?
So you want to try October?
Maybe.
October on that?
Keep it on track.
And just have it dedicated to the SOPs then? Or are we going to do a general meeting is the question.
Well, there's no prohibition against just. I'd like to focus on that. You know, that is our big project right now.
Okay.
We'll propose some dates and have Kurt email everybody and see if it works.
Since we don't have everybody here, kind of.
Right.
We don't know what Peter's is.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know.
I just recommend we go later in the month, Mr. Chair, if possible. Go 19th or 26th, maybe, if you're on Tuesdays.
26th is the board meeting.
Yeah.
Okay. My warden hasn't chimed in. The wife hasn't chimed in. I know we have something in October that's not on here. So, yes, if we could do that by way of request for possible dates.
Yeah, that's always fun.
I'm sure your favorite. I'm sorry.
You
guys are the best. We appreciate you running this whole show. Well, it looks like that's it. So, anything else?
You ready for a motion?
Yeah, motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Move. So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
11:30.
Wow. 2 hours is that?
Yeah. Hit it tight.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Did I hear you?